Well, once again, we have a beautiful day to treasure nature, perhaps best outside of this space, but perhaps by spending a few minutes talking about some of the issues about nature, we will appreciate the nature that's around us, and for today, find a strong place in that nature. My name is John McGowan. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana. I am a high school humanities teacher and director of the Global Studies Institute at Culver Academies, which is in northwestern Indiana. And I'm finishing up 2 weeks here at Holden Village with my family. And it's been my pleasure to discuss with all of you and others the issue of nature in America. So far, we've looked at the question why we go into the wild. And we focus primarily on the writings of Henry David Thoreau, who's had such a big impact on the way Americans think about nature. Yesterday, we looked at how we see nature by looking at some American writings, especially poetry, and then also looking at the art of landscape painters in America. Today, we're going to look at the question, where is our place in nature? And then tomorrow at 6:15, I will share with you a presentation on what is America. So it'll be the nature of America, but it won't have much to do with nature, but it will have a lot to do with the nature of America in preparation for the 4th of July. The main texts for all of these sessions come from a brand new collection from American Library called American Earth, edited by Bill McKibben. And it's quickly becoming one of the most important collections of American environmental and nature writing. The main point in these sessions is that how we see nature is a product of culture. So I am trained as a cultural historian, so I think it matters that I think we can learn a lot by looking at how others have seen nature, and it'll help, I think, make us critical and sharp in the way that we understand our place in nature. So where is our place in nature? According to Wendell Berry, making a place in nature is the forever unfinished life work of our species. The only thing we have to preserve nature with is culture. The only thing we have to preserve wildness with is domesticity. Today we'll look at these five things, time permitting. We'll look at what Genesis suggests about our place in nature, about whether we are a part of or apart from nature. We'll look at the impact humans have made on nature. We'll read a little excerpt from Bill McKibben and ask whether or not nature has ended. We'll then look at a writing by Barbara Kingsolver, and who suggests that we do still have a place in nature. And finally, if there's time, we'll look at what humans can do about the impact that they have made. And perhaps we can come up with a way to conserve, preserve, and sustain nature. So we begin with a simple but very difficult question. Are we a part of or apart from nature? The English teacher in me likes to point out the slight difference a space and a preposition can make. We often think that spaces don't matter. They do. Prepositions matter too. So what are we? Are we a part of or apart from nature? What do you think?
Well, as a biologist, I see we are influenced by the same things that all of nature is, in terms of the fact that we have to breathe in and out, we have to consume food and burn energy to continue life. So we're definitely part of nature, but I think psychologically we see ourselves as separate, and so that influences our actions. So I think we're both.
So we're both. Does that sound good to you?
I agree with that, but I think that our culture has made us apart from nature. We no longer know where our food comes from, that it comes from a live animal that goes around and lives and dies. And we don't. Now there's an interest in gardening and all that, but before that, kids didn't know where vegetables came from. So I think that we, in our interest of becoming sterile and efficient, we have become apart from nature, separated from it.
Mm-hmm. You talked a couple days ago about this recent book called Nature Deficit Disorder, and how young people especially need to learn the lessons of being connected to the outside. Also, some other recent books, like The Omnivore's Dilemma, looks at where our food comes from. Michael Pollan, the writer for the New York Times, has helped us see some of those connections that we've lost. Where exactly does that hamburger come from? We're not quite sure. Yeah. So we are both, and yet we are also feeling more and more separate from nature. Any other views? I think that kind of maps out the terrain. A lot of this terrain was first established in Western culture and probably in our lives as Christians through Genesis. And there's a lot of text up here, but I'm going to try to point out a couple things. We're fortunate to have a biblical scholar in our midst, so maybe he can help us a bit. One of the things that Christians have had to face in the 20th century, and now even the 21st century, is some criticism that we're not completely in touch with environmental issues, that we see ourselves as separate from nature. God gave us a sort of special role, and therefore we're not as apt to be environmentally minded. I think if you look around Holden, that's simply not true. I think if you look at many Christians in America today, I don't think that really works. But many people who question the role of Christianity in the environment point to this first chapter of Genesis. And they particularly point to a word that was supposed to really be clear and bold, and that is this word, dominion. Dominion. We are to have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. What does that mean? Does that mean that we're separate from nature? That we're this species that just sits above all of nature?
We tend to forget that before that it says we must replenish the earth.
That's right. If you look back, one verse is a really great point. If you look back into that verse, you see a wonderful statement. It says, be fruitful and multiply. In fact, environmental Christians are focusing more and more on those phrases today because they have a stronger environmental ethic to them. There's another problem in this part of Genesis, and that's the separation that you see just in the way the verses are laid out. There's, you know, God does this, God does that, he creates other things, and then he creates humans as a separate act. So we're somehow separate from those other things that got created. I mean, do you feel that way? Mm-hmm. You feel that way? Do you feel like you're separate? I mean, we are different. I mean, it's psychologically, as you said, it's very difficult to not see ourselves as separate.
I think we're one of the few animals, I think, well, some people would argue the only one, but that have a sense of self. And that has led to all of our yearning for knowledge and inquiry and our place in the world. And I think that is what sets us apart, is that desire to understand ourselves. But from a biological point of view, we're like any other animal.
Genesis 2, which biblical scholars theorize is actually from a different oral tradition, maybe even a different voice, has a different view, I think, of humans. First of all, instead of man and woman being created immediately together in Genesis 2, man is created and woman is created out of man. That's one of the most famous distinctions. But there's also a difference here in the way that he describes what humans should do. This is from the King James Version. The Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. Okay. There are two words modern Christian environmentalists have pointed to and have tried to understand more deeply. And I have to say, I'm still trying to understand these words. They are dress it and keep it in the King James Version, and I believe in the original Hebrew, it's abad and shamar. And talked a little bit with Fred Niedner, who's a Hebrew Bible scholar, about what these words mean. And abad seems to mean till or work. Is that right? And then the key word that Christians really love to focus on now is shamar. And shamar can be translated all sorts of ways. It's here as keep it. It's the same word, I think, that's used in the blessing when we leave, you know, may the Lord bless and keep you. Right? I think it's the same thing. But Christian environmentalists have used this word to say it's, we have to keep as in keep alive. That's what it's about. It's not like to preserve in formaldehyde, but to keep it. Perhaps this is, as I said, I'm not a biblical scholar, but perhaps this comes out of the culture of shepherds, right? This is the imagery I have, is people who understand what it means to keep a flock of sheep, perhaps. Fred, could you add anything to that, what these words might mean?
I know, you summarized most of its uses. I mean, it's also the word for keeping the commandments. So somehow or another, it means to live in, I mean, it can mean live in compliance, to live in accord with, to live in protection and service to. It can mean all kinds of words that have to do with having a relationship to something.
That's
a faithful relationship.
Yeah, that's a great phrase, right? It means that it is somehow in relationship to. So that I think that's an argument, in fact, for being not completely separate from, but being connected to.
I'm hung up on the word garden, because garden in the United States means, you know, like victory garden for people that are in my generation before me, and I just get hung up on it, because that's plants to me. And I don't know how we till the cattle and all of that, you know. So I get kind of hung up on, because the cattle are given to us too, to keep alive, I guess. But to till a garden is another whole thing to me.
I wonder too how much these narrative traditions were shaped by the reality of life between the Nile and the Euphrates. You know, these people are shepherds raising livestock, or
yes,
their diet is based a lot on cereals. So I think this shapes the language that we see in Scripture.
Well, it's basically the difference between a cultivated place and a wild place.
Yeah.
That's what the word for garden.
That's what it means?
Yeah, and Eden is the word for delight. So it really should have a capital G. The Garden of Delight.
Oh.
Is what it means. It's a utopia.
So this is, in some ways, the biblical ideal. Right? This is a utopia. This is a kind of biblical ideal.
But if it's a garden of delight, why would you have to do anything to it?
To make it
fruitful. A utopia would be a place where you could just walk around and pick off the bushes and eat it.
Well, but it's still a cultivated place. I mean, a garden is a cultivated place. Somebody has to trim the bushes.
Otherwise it gets overrun with weeds.
Mm-hmm. But what's a weed? Just a plant you don't like.
Yeah, it's something that doesn't help you preserve.
A wild place is one that nobody takes care of. A garden is a place that somebody takes care of.
And I think this is very much a part of the Hebrew experience. That's how I look at it as a historian. And the wonderful discussion, the wonderful thing I hope that you'll think more about. Now I'm going to try to make a shift to America, because there was a person who's influenced American environmental ideas quite a bit, who we looked at earlier in the week. And he had a definite answer. Thoreau was very clear about humans' relationship to nature. He says, "I wish to speak a word for nature, to regard man as an inhabitant or a part and parcel of nature, rather than a member of society." His divide was not between the garden and but not garden. His divide was between society and nature, and he saw himself as a part of nature. Going off into the woods and living in that cabin on Walden Pond was his way of declaring independence from society on July 4th, and also his way of saying, I am part of nature. Here's what one of my former teacher has said. So this is very much something I'm shaped by. The ways we imagine nature affect our actions. So the ways that we think about them, whether it's in Genesis or it's we're reading Thoreau or we're looking at paintings of nature or photographs of nature. And this is something I think, this is something that Bill Cronin says that I think is a nice kind of cautionary tale of some of the things that we've looked at the last couple sessions. So if we think of nature as a sublime, romanticized wilderness, or we have a nostalgia for the primitive, lost frontier, where even Indians would need to be removed to create an uninhabited wilderness, that creates a dualism, a divide, that sets humanity and nature at opposite poles, perhaps even in conflicting relationships. We thereby leave ourselves little hope of discovering what an ethical, sustainable, honorable human place in nature might look like. So this is from an environmental historian at the University of Wisconsin, and I hope this is something that you will think about as we move forward today. What has been the human impact on nature? I think this is an important question if we're to understand what our place in nature is, because we can look at this historically. What are some of the things that you can think of have been ways humans have affected nature? What have we done? Genesis says we have tilled, we have farmed. Are there other things we have done?
We've exploited.
Can you give me an example of exploitation?
Well, I think of one on the Columbia River when one of the dams was built. The Native Americans had a place called Celilah Falls where they were allowed to get their fish, and it was buried. I mean, the whole Columbia River now has been exploited to the expense of both the salmon and the Indians. That's just one. Mm-hmm. The Grand Canyon would have been inundated, the whole thing, if it hadn't been for the Sierra Club stopping two more dams that were supposed to go there.
Think of other examples?
Well, the Dust Bowl, you know, was man's impact on the prairie. Right, hauling up the prairie, and then eventually just blew away all the way to the East Coast. Yeah.
So farming habits in Oklahoma and other parts of the Great Plains pulled up the ancient sod and exposed the earth to the Dust Bowl and created an environmental and a human disaster.
Pesticides
are used as chemicals.
80 acres of mine tailings.
Yeah, 80 acres. We don't have to look far here, right, to see human impact.
Hoover Dam.
Mm-hmm. Hoover Dam.
Filling up the cavern to make power.
Yeah, so there have been many ways. I hope that we don't just see all these as negative. I mean, I think you could see where humans have made the desert bloom, made the earth, helped make the earth fruitful. But unfortunately, I'm a historian, so I'm going to look mostly at negative things here. Okay. This I think, is one human impact. The mammoth died out, of course, because it became very fashionable to have a mammoth trash can. Okay. Here is another image by an artist of what humans have done. Right? We have the famous tree of life, and a human comes by with a chainsaw and cuts it down. Okay. I hope this isn't the only way that we see human impact, but as I said, I'm going to focus on more the negative. Alexis de Tocqueville's famous commentator on America, who traveled through the upper Midwest in 1830, said this: "In Europe, people talk a great deal of the wilds of America, but the Americans themselves never think about them. Their eyes are fixed upon another sight, the march across the wilds, draining swamps, turning the course of rivers, peopling solitudes, and subduing nature." And this was considered a good thing, a very good thing. And as a result, we got this. This is an image we saw very briefly yesterday, but it's one I think and sums up very much that march of America across the West, the classic narrative of America, with the mountains and the buffalo and the Indians representing nature being pushed off the left side of the screen, and we have all of the things that would shape the American environment. We've got the miners, we have the pioneers in their Conestoga wagons, we've got the stagecoach by Wells Fargo, the farmer tilling his field, the railway coming in, the telegraph wire, and the public schools bringing surely progress. And back in the distance, we see what has been created behind this glorious civilization of bridges and buildings and sailing ships, which can take the bounties of nature and ship them all over the world. Now, this is, I think, an example not only of American manifest destiny, but of what Americans considered progress. This is a more realistic image of that impact. This is a picture from about the same time of a railway. And you can see just on the edges of this river here how much impact that just building a railway would have on nature. It's literally been recarved and reshaped. Now, as it became recarved and reshaped, there are many Americans who became kind of nostalgic for what it once was. In 1890, the U.S. Census found no clear frontier. Frederick Jackson Turner wrote a famous thesis about this in 1893. He said, it's the frontier more than anything that shaped what Americans think of themselves. Owen Wister, that great Western writer, described the world of the horseman as a vanished world. And Frederick Remington quickly bought a horse and headed out west to capture it before it would disappear. And as a result, he created some of the most wonderful sculpture in American art. Here we see a Cheyenne Indian literally flying across the countryside. This is one of the first sculptures, actually, by the way, that captured horses as they actually run without physically touching the ground. And Remington creates the illusion by using dust as a way of holding up the whole sculpture. That's one of my favorites. Another artist in the 1930s showed the way humans, the way Americans reshaped nature this way. Got ducks flying freely in 1920, 1930, lots of hunters come by having a great old time, and by 1940, all the animals are in the zoo. And in some ways, this is the history of America's response to the environment. This is kind of how we did it. This is obviously an exaggeration. And then here's an image of our own Holden. And by comparison, actually, to some of these things that we've seen, this is not all that huge. So I was walking up on the tailings yesterday, and I was just from the third level looking down. It's just a very large pile, very large impact. But you can see the trees growing up through there. So. This is perhaps a more stunning example of what humans can do. This is the Chainsaw of Summer, actually a fairly famous art photograph of clear cutting. And this is the Tongass rainforest in Alaska, and how by building roads and clear cutting, a huge swath of forest could disappear. Here's another example, another artistic photograph. I wish I didn't put up the caption on this yet. I should have asked you what you thought this was. Some people have compared this to a whole pan of fried eggs.
Yeah.
Okay. But actually, it's an aeration pond taken in 1989 in Arkansas. We have lots of these around the country.
What's the scale on
that? What's the scale on this one?
Yeah.
Enormous. I mean, you're looking at probably every one of those little eggs could be a football field. This, I think, is an interesting thing, especially as a car driver who's replaced a lot of tires over my lifetime. This is, at one time, considered the world's largest tire pile. But in some ways, it's still a beautiful photograph, absolutely beautiful photograph of a horrifying reality. And then, of course, Chris Madden, a great cartoonist, has his own view of these human impacts. Right. Chopping down all the trees gives us a great view, doesn't it, of how we've chopped down all the trees. And the original inhabitants of this land had a saying, every time you take something from the earth, you must give something back. So we take and then we leave our waste.
Have you ever seen the cartoon? It's mining uranium at night so you can make uranium to mine uranium at night. Make electricity to mine uranium at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're often caught in this vicious cycle.
Yeah.
This is an image we saw very briefly yesterday, but I wanted to put it up on the screen again because it shows how we try to create nature in our own backyards while the changes that we've made to nature are sometimes just in our view, with the large power plant and a garden mixed together in this 2004 photograph. And then yesterday we looked at perhaps the ultimate in human control of nature, literally farming on skyscrapers. This is a vision of a new New York City that we may be in a not too distant future. Perhaps this says it best. Now, this is the environmental historian Bill Cronin, who says, people have been manipulating the natural world at various scales for as long as we've had a record of their passing. Right? Think about it. There is no way to live without an impact. Here at Holden, we are trying to live with less impact. And every time we have a piece of trash, we somehow think about it in a way we normally don't think about it, because we have to find out where it exactly needs to go. My house, it's easy. It's trash or it's recycling. Here we have lots of choices. And I've seen a few confused people after they finish their first lunch meal here, right, trying to figure it out. Basically, what we're trying to do is figure out what kind of impact we're going to have. But the dilemma we face is not whether or not we're going to make an impact. It's what kind of marks we wish to leave. That's really the question for all humans today, and I think especially for Christians.
Ooh.
Ouch. Okay. Now, one writer who's looked a lot at this is Bill McKibben. And I hope everyone has a copy of that now. This is from a book he wrote called The End of Nature.
Are there extras?
There should be some.
Quite good.
Pass them.
That's King
Solver. And I don't know if we have any more, but if you could share, that would be great.
I can just listen to.
Okay. McKibben wrote this in 1989. This is a year after the UN exploration into climate change was beginning to see some climate change. And a NASA scientist definitely said, we are past the point of no return. We're bringing about global warming. And McKibben wrote this book as the first book addressed to a popular audience about global warming. And his point, or the observation that he made, is as a result of human interaction with nature and literally changing the biosphere, we no longer were separate from nature, but we had ended nature. And to get at this, I'd like to just look at the first few paragraphs. And I'd like it if I could have a few volunteers to read. We're going to skip the first paragraph because this talks about a hike that he made up a hill. And then we'll look at the real meat of his argument. This is the first page, 718, bottom of that page, the first paragraph. I wonder if you'd have a volunteer to read that paragraph and the rest of us can listen to it closely. Okay, so it starts with, now that we have changed.
Now that we have changed the most basic forces around us, the noise of the chainsaw will always be in the woods. We have changed the atmosphere, and that will change the weather. The temperature and rainfall are no longer to be entirely the work of some separate, uncivilizable force, but instead in part product of our habits, our economies, and our ways of life. Even in the most remote wilderness, where the strictest laws forbid the felling of a single tree, the sound of that saw will be clear, and a walk in the woods will be changed, tainted, by its whine. The world outdoors will mean much the same thing as the world indoors, the hill, the same thing as the house.
Yeah, you're doing this beautifully. Yeah, keep going. Mm-hmm. Great.
An idea or relationship can go extinct just like an animal or a plant. The idea in this case is, quote, nature, the separate and wild province, the world apart from man to which he adapted, under whose rules he was born and died. In the past, we spoiled and polluted parts of that nature, inflicting environmental, quote, damage. But that was like stabbing a man with toothpicks. Though it hurt, annoyed, degraded, It did not touch vital organs, block the path of a lymph for blood. We never thought that we had wrecked nature. Deep down, we never really thought we could. It was too big and too old. Its forces, the wind, the rain, and the sun, were too strong and too elemental. But quite by accident, it turned out that the carbon dioxide and other gases we were producing in our pursuit of a better life, in pursuit of warm houses and eternal economic growth, and of agriculture so productive it would free most of us from farming, could alter the power of the sun, could increase its heat, and that increase could change the patterns of moisture and dryness, breed storms in new places and breed deserts. These things may or may not have yet begun to happen, but it is too late to altogether prevent them from happening. We have produced the carbon dioxide, we are ending nature.
One more paragraph.
We have not ended rainfall or sunlight. In fact, rainfall and sunlight may become more important forces in our lives. It is too early to tell exactly how much harder the wind will blow, how much hotter the sun will shine. That is for the future. But the meaning of the wind, the sun, and the rain of nature has already changed. Yet the wind still blows, but no longer from the same from some other sphere, some inhuman place.
So, according to McKibben, how has nature ended?
At our hand.
Well, I'm not sure what he's saying. Is it that we've so fundamentally altered nature, or is it our relationship with nature that's changed?
He does say that we've altered nature. What are the ways in which you say we have altered nature?
Well, he talks about pursuing a better life.
And the sum of all of those activities has created something bigger that we didn't intend.
Global climate change.
Which is global climate change. So by the little things that we've done around the edges, by basically acting locally, we've had a global impact. And now, so what exactly does he mean, though, by ending nature? Is it that we killed nature, or is it we've changed our relationship with it?
I think it must mean change our relationship with it. It's absurd to think that we can kill nature.
He has this wonderful set of metaphors there on that second page, 719, halfway down the first paragraph. It was like in this first phase, we were simply stabbing a man with toothpicks, right? But now what we've done is we've actually changed the meaning of all of those things. So that's the key word, I think, here. That's the last paragraph that we heard. The meaning of the wind, the sun, and the rain of nature has changed, and therefore our place in nature has changed. So for McKibben, this is the biggest impact humans can have on nature, changing the whole biosphere, and thus our relationship with nature. Now, is there a place for us in nature? We may have changed the relationship, but is there a place? This is, in some ways, the question that Barbara Kingsolver raises in her essay that I've handed out. Some more copies here if anyone needs one. Bill McKibben, who's a journalist, started writing for the New Yorker magazine and then got interested in environmental issues. Barbara Kingsolver, on the other hand, was interested in the environment from the very beginning of her career. She was trained as a biologist, and then out of being a biologist, she became a writer, and a very good writer. Have any of you read anything by Barbara Kingsolver? What things do you remember that you've read?
Prodigal Summer.
Yeah, it's Prodigal Summer.
Poisonwood Bible.
In fact, there are copies of that in the bookstore. That's about missionaries.
Animal, mineral, vegetable.
This is her most recent book, where she tries to live off of local food. Prodigal Summer, though, is her take of life in Appalachia, where she really weaves in all of the natural world and naturalists into her story. In this essay, she writes about her life as a writer. And I'm going to take you through the first part of the article on it so we can get to the last page where her answer to this question is most clearly stated. She says in the very first line, this is on page 939, "I have places where all my stories begin." Do you have any such places where your stories begin? What a wonderful first line for a story. right? So sharp, so clean, so short, right? And I think she connects with us immediately because, yes, I've got places too. My stories, my life begins in particular places, and I go back to them. For some of them, from some of you, it's actually coming back here many times. And the two places that she singles out, are the two places where she does most of her writing. One is a log cabin in Appalachia, made from the dead trees of the chestnut blight. So these are the old trunks of chestnut trees that died in a blight. And the other place she talks about is Arizona, the highlands above Tucson, Arizona. And there she's confronted by nature. And she's just right outside of her window as she writes. On page 943, the first full paragraph, halfway down, she describes actually the interaction with a bobcat. "I turned my head slowly to meet the gaze of an adolescent bobcat at my window. Whether he meant to be the first to read the story on my computer screen or was lured in by his own reflection in the quirky afternoon light, I cannot say. I can tell you, though, I looked straight into bronze-colored bobcat eyes and held my breath for longer than I knew I could." The next paragraph, the last few lines, she says, "The window is the world opening onto me, and I find I don't look out so much as it pours in." What I mean to say is I have come to depend on these places where I live and work. I consider myself lucky beyond words to be able to go to work every morning with something like a wilderness at my elbow. And then we're going to go to the last full piece of paper. This is on page 946. And we'll read the rest of the essay. So I'd like if we have a volunteer for each paragraph. So each paragraph will have another reader. And then as we read, think about how she's defining her place and what could be our place in nature.
"What we lose in our great human exodus from the land is a rooted sense, as deep and intangible as religious faith, of why we need to hold on to the wild and beautiful places that once surrounded us. We seem to succumb so easily to the prevailing human tendency to pave such places over, build subdivisions upon them, and name them the Willows, or Peregrine's Roost, or Elk Meadows, after whatever it was that got killed there. Apparently, it's hard for us humans to doubt, even for a minute, that this program of plunking down our edifices at regular intervals over the entire landmass of planet Earth is overall a good idea. To attempt to slow or change the program is a tall order."
Mary Lopez writes that if we hope to succeed in the endeavor of protecting natures other than our own, it will require that we reimagine our lives. It will require of many of us a humanity we've not yet mustered, and a grace we were not aware that we desired until we had tasted it.
"And yet no endeavor could be more crucial at this moment. Protecting the land that once provided us with our genesis may turn out to be the only real story there is for us. The land still provides our genesis, however we might like to forget that our food comes from dank, muddy earth, that the oxygen in our lungs was recently inside a leaf, and that every newspaper or book we may pick up, including this one ultimately, though recycled, is made from the hearts of trees that die for the sake of our imagined lives. What you hold in your hands right now beneath these words is consecrated air and time and sunlight, and first of all, a place. Whether we are leaving it or coming into it, it's here that matters. It is this. It is place, whether we understand where we are or don't. That is the story, to be here or not to be. Storytelling is as old as our need to remember where the water is, where the best food grows, where we find our courage for the hunt. It's as persistent as our desire to teach our children how to live in the place that we have known longer than they have. Our greatest and smallest explanations for ourselves grow from place, as surely as carrots grow in the dirt. I'm presuming to tell you something that I could not prove rationally, but instead feel as religious faith. I can't believe otherwise."
more readers.
A world is looking over my shoulder as I write these words. My sensors are bobcats and mountains. I have a place from which to tell my stories. So do you, I expect. We sing the song of our home becoming because we are animals, and an animal is no better or wiser or safer than its habitat and its food chain. Among the greatest of all gifts is to know our place.
And we'll stop right there for a moment. What does she suggest is our place in these paragraphs? And how do we find it? What do we need to do to find our place?
Open our eyes.
Open our eyes. Does she like the changes that have taken place in America?
No.
So what's her antidote to it? What's her cure, so to speak?
She mentioned slowing down somewhere, I can't remember now. Attempt to slow the change of program to stall her.
I'm sorry. She just says we need to connect with nature, and in doing so, we will find our place in it. And I think that may mean if you're lucky, you have a place in the woods that you can retreat to, but if not, you look to your garden or somewhere else to find a connection with your food chain, or with some other aspect of nature that you rely upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she suggests that wild places are the most important. And in the very last few lines, she says, oh, how can I see this people need wild places? Whether or not we think we do, we do. We need to be able to taste grace and know once again that we desire it. We need to experience a landscape that is timeless, whose agenda moves at a pace of speciation and glaciers. To be surrounded by a singing, mating, howling commotion of other species, all of which love their lives as much as we do ours. And none of which could possibly care less about our economic status or our running day calendar. Right? She anthropomorphizes nature in a really beautiful way, poetically. Wildness puts us in our place. It reminds us that our plans are small and somewhat absurd, almost like a Hudson River School painting that some of you saw yesterday. It reminds us why, in those cases in which our plans might influence many future generations, we ought to choose carefully. I think that's a very profound statement, right? We need to think about many generations and what that impact will be. Looking out on a clean plank of planet Earth, we can get shaken right down to the bone by the bronze-eyed possibility of lives that are not our own. So she sees her life sometimes as not even her own, as a part of something bigger than herself. That's McKibben's view, and then another modern writer who's King Solomon's view. Which do you like better?
King Solomon.
King Solomon. Now, why would that be? Right? McKibben is, I think, challenging us. Right? He's challenging us to say, you know, we've made a much bigger impact than we think. And we can't get away with sort of excusing that impact. We need to look at it very closely. King Solomon is suggesting that there's still hope for us. There's still a way out. And she sees it in connecting and finding our place in nature. Now, this is how Wallace Stegner responded to this problem. Wallace Stegner, a great writer of the West, says, we are the most dangerous species of life on the planet, and every other species, even Earth itself, has cause to fear our power to exterminate. Do you believe that?
Yes.
Is that true? Maybe that's a very perverse version of dominion in that Genesis 1, isn't it? We've maybe taken dominion too far, and we need to get a different definition. But we are also the only species, when it chooses to do so, will go to great effort to save what it might destroy. So there's a way out for us. There's a possibility of it. Now, I don't have a whole lot of time. We've got about 10 minutes. I'm going to zip through the history of environmental actions in America, and then end with perhaps some other ways that we can think about our relationship to nature. Okay. So we start off, I'm going to go really fast, we start off with a romantic view of nature in the 19th century, with Thoreau writing Walden, the Hudson River School paintings, painters painting these beautiful landscapes like the one on the screen of Yosemite. And as a result, people create parks. An artist comes up with the idea for the First Nations Park, but it isn't until over 30 years later that the U.S. creates a grant of land to the state of California called Yosemite and the First Nations Park at Yellowstone in 1872. Other things happen. And here is perhaps that view of nature, right? This great big landscape of nature that needs to be set aside as a park, Yosemite. Then the next phase of environmental action in America to try to respond to the impact that humans make is conservation. The idea that the conservationists have is that nature should be managed. They have a very utilitarian and what they consider also a democratic view. They believe that you should come up with the greatest good for the greatest number. And we do this today in our policies. Many of these acts that you see up here, everything from the Forest Reserve Act to the Antiquities Act to the National Park Service Act, are all things that are functioning in our society and are ways in which we try to control the impact that we have on nature. But if you've been to a national park recently, you know that sometimes that we can actually love nature to death because there are, you know, literally millions of people who go through these parks every year. One of the most famous debates in the story of in what kind of impact humans are going to have in America is a debate between conservation and preservation. You can see the two groups, the two people that represent these movements on these two slides. On the one side, you see Gifford Pinchot. He's with his boss, Teddy Roosevelt, who's president at the time. And on the other side is John Muir, who's with his friend, Teddy Roosevelt. So we should have these slides somehow so we can put Teddy Roosevelt in the middle and John Muir on one side and Gifford Pinchot on the other. Gifford Pinchot was a conservationist. He was a utilitarian. He believed that we should come up with the greatest good for the greatest number. And for him, that was a very progressive idea. And for America, that was a real change. Before this, U.S. hadn't done anything to preserve its forests. It just let whoever owned the property do whatever they wanted to the property. And what he did was come up with a way to manage these forests for the greatest good. John Muir, though, saw nature as something that was sacred, a temple. He worshipped it. Coming out of his congregational background in the Midwest, he went to the Sierras and he literally drank communion with the trees. He literally tapped sequoias and drank their juice and called it his communion with nature. Amazing guy, also a founder of the Sierra Club. And the big problem they had is depicted in this image of the fire that hit San Francisco after the great earthquake of 1906. This is what forced the debate in America. And it's the debate we're still having between greatest good for the greatest number and preservation of this sort of idealized nature. Now, how would this have to do with this big debate? Well, huge earthquake followed by a big fire. The earthquake burst or broke all the water pipes, so there's no way to fight the fire. So San Francisco was as devastated by fire as it was by the earthquake. And so San Francisco needed to come up with a new water supply. This is so much, so human, this is so American, right? We've got this problem, we've got to come up with a solution. How are we going to solve it? And the solution was up here in the Sierra Mountains called Hetch Hetchy Valley. This is what it looked like in 1908. This is the sacred temple that Muir liked to worship in, and for Gifford Pinchot and the U.S. government, it was a great location for a dam to create a water source that would be never-ending for San Francisco and solve their water problems so there would never be a big fire. And the result was the dam was built. Muir lost. But in many ways, his ideas would come to grip America even more than utilitarianism. What happened after that was preservation. So this next phase of American environmental action was preservation. Nature should be preserved for its own sake. And you can look here at this endless list. This is actually a shortened list of all the ways that preservationists try to just preserve nature, whether it was stopping dams or it was battles over old growth forests and endangered species in Oregon in just the last 20 years. So for them, looking at this image was horrifying. This is Hetch Hetchy Valley today with a dam there. One of the key ugly marks for them is this bathtub ring that you see around the edge of the valley. But ironically, some now have said there are fewer people that go to this valley, so it may be more preserved than Yosemite with its millions of people every year. Now, for these preservationists in the 1980s, in our own lifetime, this is some of the stuff they've put up on the web.
Right.
So they've got this photograph of the dam, and what they'd like to do is put a crack in this dam, get rid of it, and let the river run free.
That's a big piece of plastic.
Yeah, very big piece of plastic. Okay. The next phase of environmentalism is pollution control. And this is a classic story of the environment that I think Bill McKibben only says the end of. It begins with addressing local pollution. Things like water pollution, cholera in the mid-19th century, and then also smoke from the industrial cities like Pittsburgh or Chicago. And that's the first phase. The next phase is regional, where we're looking at things like the smokestack that pollutes the whole Midwest. Then we look at national problems like acid rain, where coal generating power plants in the Midwest cause acid rain in New England and Canada. And then the final phase of all this is a global issue. This is the one that Bill McKibben's talking about, how collectively all these little actions lead to increased carbon in the atmosphere, greenhouse effect, and global warming. We can trace this movement from local to national to global by looking at the story of the American environment and environmental movement. One of the first things that we could call environmentalism would be the ecology of the 1960s, best represented by Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, where she attacked all the chemicals that were going into our environment. She did this beautifully in a very literary way. She did it by telling a story and then weaving the chemistry into that story. If you haven't had a chance to look at it recently, it's worth going back to again. John Kennedy said of the book, kind of making a reference to Harriet Beecher Stowe and slavery, says, "Oh, so you're the woman who started this whole environmental campaign." As a result of Rachel Carson's book and the work of a lot of environmentalists, there was a lot of effort to control chemicals, air pollution, and even oil drilling and nuclear power in the United States. So this is the ecology movement in America. The next one would be what historians call the new environmentalism. This new environmentalism was shaped by this familiar image of the Earth rising, right? Perhaps one of the most powerful images of the 20th century. No longer, right, well, we go to the moon, and what we find there isn't the moon. What we find is this beautiful planet behind the astronauts. It made the cover of Life magazine in 1968 and would become an iconic image of our world. As a result, we have the first Earth Day in 1970, the UN Conference on the Environment in 1972, and campaigns against acid rain, and even fears of nuclear winter during the Cold War of the 1980s. One of the results of the new environmentalism, though, is a kind of corporate environmentalism. All of these big institutions, the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, professional environmentalists, people who go to an office in Washington, D.C. It's during this time that the Sierra Club moves from California to Washington, D.C., so they can spend all of their time lobbying congressmen and fighting court battles in federal courts. This might be one of the results of it. Okay. All right. And then the most recently, though, we've been thinking about global environmentalism. This is Bill McKibben's view. Where global climate change represents a global problem. So it's no longer, we just can't worry about what's happening in our own backyard. We've got to think about how what we do, like say for me driving my car to work, affects the whole globe. And it's, we've seen it in campaign protests against the WTO. We've seen this in Al Gore's famous movie, Inconvenient Truth, which won the Academy Award and would call attention to his organization, which would lead to a Nobel Peace Prize. And as we are speaking here, I believe Congress is debating whether or not to have a climate change bill. Right. So we now look at our environment this way. The four truck drivers of the apocalypse, toxic waste, natural resources, the military, and of course the burger. One of my favorite foods. Okay. This is how E.O. Wilson described it. This is a problem for us, especially as Americans. Okay. He says, in the 21st century, we're going to pass through a bottleneck. The land required to maintain a center of American, one American. That's my life, it's 12 acres. The amount required for someone in a developing country, where 80% of the people live, that's 1 acre, okay? Right, so we're using about 12 times as much land resources as everybody else in the world. Now here's the problem, guess what? And I know this from going to China. The rest of the world wants to be like us,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay? This is the problem. And I think as we as Christians who believe that our actions not only count for what they do, but also what they show, is I think it's a very important thing for us to think about. So the results of the impossibility of everyone rushing to be like Americans could be catastrophic. We may need many more Earths than what we have. Okay. Somewhat in response to this is a new movement called Deep Ecology and Sustainability. It began in the 80s and caught on in the 90s, and in many ways is shaping how people look at the environment today. We've got writers like Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson. You're talking about sustainable agriculture, which is, I think, what we hear most recently in Barbara Kingsolver's most recent book, Animal, Mineral, Vegetable, and also in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. This deep ecology, I think, is going throughout the environmental movement today, where we believe that we should live in harmony with nature. And then, but there's also this other movement that's coming in, and that's natural capitalism, where we believe that perhaps with technology, like wind power and solar power, we can address the environmental challenges that we have. So this perhaps is the way we think about sustainability today. Okay. I love Chris Madden. Now I want to just end here in the last minute with an example from a Christian zoologist named Calvin DeWitt. His name suggests that he's a little more Calvinist than Lutheran. So if we can get by that, I think Lutherans might be able to learn something from him. He's spent a lot of time not only being a zoologist, but also studying his Bible, especially as a good Calvinist, his Hebrew Scriptures. And he comes out of the Hebrew Scriptures with three main concepts and then one overarching one. And I'd like you to think about these as we think back to Genesis. First of all, he thinks that Christians should be really concerned with earthkeeping. He goes back to that word shamar, where keep creatures alive in habitats, not in arks. He also believes in fruitfulness. This is a word that someone pointed out was very important when we looked at the first chapter of Genesis. He also believes in the Sabbath. This is one of the concepts here at Holden, too, is Sabbath. And here he takes a phrase and kind of rearranges it. In the Bible, in the New Testament, it says the Sabbath is not for man. The Sabbath is made for man, not the man for the Sabbath. But here he says the land needs a Sabbath. So we need to be thinking about how we rotate things. And then finally, his overarching concept is this word of conserving. So he's redefining conservation, where he sees con, meaning with, and then serving. So we're supposed to be serving with nature. And I think this, for him, shapes a very Christian modern view of stewardship. I want to end with one last quote. This is by the environmental historian Bill Cronin. Idealizing a distant wilderness too often means not idealizing the environment in which we live. People should always be conscious that they are part of the natural world, inextricably tied to the ecological system that sustains their lives. It is no less crucial to recognize and honor non-human nature as a world we did not create, a world with its own independent non-human reasons for being as it is. And that will end our session. Thank you very much.